works. Good afternoon and welcome to not the last one, but one of the last sessions here at TechEd. This session is about deploying Hyper-V hosts, as it says on the screen, using Microsoft System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2012. Now, we are going to, I am, not we, I am going to show you how this works with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. It doesn't mean that this is the only option you have. There are other options to install host machines too. So you need to figure this out if this is going to be something that fits your organization and your environment. Before we do that, my name is Michael Nyström. I live in Sweden. I work as a consultant and a trainer. I have installed Windows for a long time. And I do actually love questions. And just to make it a bit more fun, I have three signed books from the authors and the guy that actually wrote Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, Mr. Michael Niehaus, in the audience. So for good, valid questions, you will receive a book. No, I don't have 100 copies of the book. I only have three copies, which means the first three questions will be received by a book. Now, to make this work, you're going to need a couple of things. Number one is that you do need a reference image. There are so many ways of creating a reference image. One of them is simply just take the existing image that you have on the DVD, and the other one is to make it a bit more professional, using a tool to create it. You also need at least one server, and that server needs to have IPMI, DCMI, or SMASH. I prefer SMASH because it's much more fun to say. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter. You need a Pixie server. You can, in some cases, share the Pixie server with other components, and in some cases, you need a dedicated Pixie server. If you do have a Pixie server that runs together with System Center Configuration Manager, they don't like each other. Otherwise, it works perfectly fine. You need a host profile, and you need to configure a logical network. And in many cases, you also need just the small portions of PowerShell. And I'm going to show you why. And you also need to have a very understanding family. I was testing my lab environment this morning between 1 and 2. I stopped testing at 2 because I received a text message from my girlfriend. She sleeps next to my servers. And when you deploy servers, they fire up with the massive noise when the fan starts. And she was supposed to work at 6 a.m. this morning. She wasn't very happy. I have some excuses to do when I come home. Number one is to create the reference image. It needs to be a VHD image. Some customers say, "Well, can I use the same VHD that I use to deploy my virtual machines?" In theory, you can. In reality, no. In theory, it works because it is a VHD file, right? In reality, the components that you would like to have in your reference image on a host machine is not likely to be the same as the components you have on a web server or a domain controller or a SQL server. It's going to be the same operating system, but not more than that. I need this to be automated. I need this to be automated in a way so I can create a reference image over and over again, and it will end up the same way, fully patched, fully working, so I can redeploy or deploy new host machines without thinking, "Does it work this time?" I need to try this and spend hours and hours on testing it. It also needs to be documented. In my small world, together with a bunch of other peoples on this planet. That means Microsoft Deployment Toolkit 2012. Demo. So, I'm not going to show you how to install Microsoft Deployment Toolkit because those sessions are over and over again, so we have seen that many times before, but I want to show you the basics of this. Microsoft Deployment Toolkit requires some kind of operating system. I prefer a server operating system. Doesn't have to be. It does require .NET Framework 3.51 if you run it on the server 2008 R2, and it does require the Windows Automated Installation Kit, or the ADK if you prefer to use that. When you have installed that, you simply import the operating systems by right-clicking, selecting the ISO image, and say import operating system, which means that you will have all the operating system in here. We do not need any drivers, but you might need some applications to be installed. And as you might expect, I'm not going to install IE9 on my host machines, and I'm not going to install Office 2010 either. But I do need the Visual C++ runtimes for numerous versions of agents. If I do not install these in the reference image, the agent itself will install, but it doesn't install the latest version. It installs the version that comes with the agent. Normally that means the RTM version. That means that you need to run Windows Update immediately after you have deployed the machine to try to avoid all these manually things I need to do after I install the agents already from the beginning. There might also be a scenario when you use Operation Manager. Anybody using Operation Manager? So I do that too. I would prefer to install the agent at the same time, so the Operation Manager agent is already installed. Another agent that I really like much is the Data Protection Manager agent, and I install that in the reference image, or I install it at deploy time, but it's nice to have all these agents in the machine from the beginning, because then I don't need to worry so much about opening the firewall. Anybody try to do a Data Protection Manager agent deployment from the server, and it didn't work? And you were reading the document about you need to modify the firewall, and then you realize that you need to modify the firewall pretty much. You just need to open all the ports between 1024 and 65535. Yeah, that's a small modification to the firewall. If the agent is installed, the agent will open the ports automatically, and then you can attach the agent directly, which is easier. It is possible to do it in another way. Today we have Orchestrator, and we can have Orchestrator fix all these things if we want to do that. I'm an old guy, so I do a lot of these things in the reference image from the beginning. The operating system. I do have the application, I create a task sequence, and I have to be honest with you. I know that Microsoft says we should go for core server. I don't work for Microsoft. I can have my own opinion. That means that if the customer I'm working with is perfectly satisfied with core, they can manage core, they understand core, they work with core, they have the knowledge, then I do core. If the customer doesn't have the knowledge of core, I don't do core. I do a UI version instead. If they're going to manage it, they need something they can manage. Of course, they should learn core server, but I can't force them. And I'd like my customers to be happy. Strange, right? No, not that strange. So you create the task sequence, pretty basic, new task sequence. You give it an ID. Sorry. Hyper-V host. C1. Windows Server 2008, almost. X64 Hyper-V host ref, something like that. Next, switch to eServer task sequence. Next, pick the operating system. And let's go for data center core this time. Next, don't need a key, need a configuration. Don't specify the password. You can, of course, specify the password. The password will end up in an unattended XML file. If you don't specify the password, you can use the custom settings.ini in the rules settings tab in MDT to say the admin password is. And I prefer to do that's because I have a very short memory. If people ask me for a password I used 6 months ago, I can't even remember my password last week when I was a customer. I'm horrible at that. I'm sorry. You do all this, okay? And then we need to have a boot image. So the boot image is created by configuring the rules we would like to have. We specify the name and password to attach to my file share. I specify settings that I would like to run while I'm doing this. All these settings is because I don't like to show the UI in MDT. So in this case, the machine will fire up, ask me for a task sequence, which is going to be my reference image. I click next, I wait an hour, and then it's done. Which means that if I remove the last select task sequence, the only thing I need to have to create the reference image in that case is power up a virtual machine, wait an hour, and you're done. The only difference is that normally we select to do a sysprep and capture to create a WIM file. I don't. I do a sysprep turn off, which means that that virtual machine I was using now have a VHD file. I take that VHD file and copy it into my System Center Virtual Machine Manager library. And that means it's also a bit faster because the sysprep and capture process takes time. The actual installation of a core server together with Windows Update is roughly somewhere around half an hour. So it takes half an hour to create the reference image, which is pretty fast. So why do I use this solution? Well, I use this solution because I create reference images for numerous things, not only System Center Virtual Machine Manager. I also have Configuration Manager for some customers, and Light Touch for some customers, and WDS for some customers. I need something that works with all of them, and this one do. There is another way to create a reference images. Let's say that you're going back home tomorrow morning. You have nothing to do, obviously, so you're going to play with this, and you really need to create a reference image really, really fast. Well, you can use something called WIM2VHD. There is a bunch of PowerShell scripts and a VB scripts for the old operating system that actually just mount the WIM file, run ImageX, apply against a VHD file, and that takes roughly 6 minutes on my SSD drive. It's not going to be patched, it doesn't contain any of the applications, but I have a good, valid VHD file to verify that my solution works. So WIM2VHD is another solution. It's cheating, and I love cheating. We need a server, and I told you before we need something that supports the following protocol. It either needs to support IPMI, we need to have version 1.5 or 2.0, or higher. So how many servers do you believe supports IPMI? Well, IPMI is one of those acronyms that is the real one. ILO is a branded version of that. DRAC is another branded version of that, which means that most of the system we have really supports IPMI. DCMI is another one which is very close to be IPMI. So most system that supports IPMI also supports DCMI. Not all, most of them. SMASH, however, is different. Dell is switching into SMASH, and SMASH is a bit more richer because we can do other things with SMASH, like hardware monitoring and verifying things pretty much like the operating system agent can do, CPU, memory, and things like that. IPMI is cheaper, simpler, easier to work with. You also need a machine that supports Hyper-V, otherwise it's going to be really hard to enable the Hyper-V role on that machine. There is a small issue, since this has been around for a couple of years, but not many vendors are using it, which means that even if you do have a machine that really supports this, it might not work anyway. You might really need to have a firmware upgrade because you're using IPMI on that server for the first time in that machine's life because it has never been used before. So you didn't know about all the bugs and patches that you need to have. Depends on the vendor, but when I go out to customer and we build these solutions, we do need to firmware update basically every server they have. If there are new servers, if they are old, they work without patching. I don't know why. That's a story anyway. So we need to be able to log on to the BMC. And the BMC can be logged on in different ways, and here's one of them. Now, I'm not trying to tell you to use these kind of servers. This is an HP ProLiant microserver. This is most likely the worst Hyper-V host you can ever buy. It's a small box. It has a maximum of 8 gigs of RAM, and it runs a CPU of 1.3 gigahertz. It's just a piece of thing. Yeah, it's a piece of hardware. But it has one benefit. It's the cheapest thing you can buy to test IPMI out, because the server has a price level of cheaper than the cheapest laptop you can find. And it's pretty quiet. And it also has a really good benefit, because this is really badly designed, which means that I really need to do awkward things to make this work. You need to be able to log into this machine, and you need to make sure that IPMI actually is selected. It is normally selected by default, but we sometimes get refurbished servers, and they are not really default settings at all. And you also need to define what level of access the IPMI actually have to that machine. As you can see, the encryption key is very secure, and you shouldn't modify that at all. If you don't have that kind of server, maybe you have another one like this. This is another not-so-great server. That is the HP ML150. It's a workgroup server. But for demo purposes, it's pretty easy to use, too. In our production environment, we don't really have those servers. We have other servers. And in this case, we don't have that. Sorry, commercial crap. Let me switch over to the correct server. No, it should be here. Here it is. That is the Blade Center we actually run. It's a C7000, and the blades are 460CG7. So you need to have access to this machine, and you need to have an admin name and a password. If you do have a chassis, you cannot use the onboard administrator password. You really need to have a password on each and every ILO interface. which means that that takes a couple of minutes to actually make sure that I can log on to these machines. There are some things that you really need to know, and that is things like the UID number. Now, this is the small issue. It should be like this. If I connect to your IPMI card and I ask you for your GUID number, it should return the GUID number for that machine. Some of the machines have multiple GUID numbers, one for the remote access card and one for the actual hardware. The problem is when we fire up the machine, we are pre-staging the machine in the WDS server, and we're telling it, next time this machine boots with this GUID number, you should pixie boot him, and you should pixie boot him on this media. Problem is, fires up with another GUID number, so it never really boots, and you spend a couple of hours figuring out why, which means that if everything seems perfectly fine, you're able to power the machine up. The machine powers up, and it tries to pixie boot, but it doesn't receive a boot file. It just continues. It says press F12 to continue. In that case, you have a mismatch between the GUID number that IPMI is giving you and a GUID number that the machine actually has. That is most commonly solved by firmware update. But in some cases, it's not. And then you need to twist it with PowerShell. So we need Pixie. We need Windows Deployment Services, which in that case requires DHCP to work, which means that we then need to have an Active Directory, which doesn't matter because we're going to need Active Directory anyway, otherwise System Center Virtual Machine Manager doesn't work. We need to have an admin account in the WDS server. And we do have some issues here. It is not recommended to run multiple WDS servers in the same network. Since that is a broadcast protocol, we're going to have issues. But I would like to just give you a hint on how you can do this without reconstructing your complete infrastructure when you get back home. Not supported, but it works. Because I do have multiple WDS servers in my network. I do have multiple VMM servers too. And I installed the WDS server on the VMM server. And I configure it a bit differently from what you normally do. So, go into Server Manager, I switching, there you go, and the only thing we need to do is this, pixie response, respond only to known client computers. That means it's only going to be picking up machines that is pre-staged using System Center Virtual Machine Manager. However, that doesn't solve the complete problem. To find the other one. Oh, there it is. Since I have another server in the network, which hopefully is that server, that happens to have a WDS server, that one has another setting. You see the difference? It says respond to everything, 2 seconds, and it also says delay in seconds 10. Which means that if the machine is pre-staged, it's going to be picked up by the WDS server that has that record, and he's going to be happy and boot. Because this one will answer first after 10 seconds. So it's not perfect. You shouldn't do this. But if you would like to evaluate and try and test things, it works. Otherwise, you should only have one. We had a question over here. No, it doesn't stage it in Active Directory. It stages it on the WDS server. It does that when you add the machine. Exactly at the same step that you add the machine and say, sorry? After deep discovery. It's when you create the machine, it's actually going to be staged. No, deep discovery does, sorry, before deep discovery, yes. So, because to be able to do deep discovery, which is a new feature of System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2010, yes, it's going to add it as a pre-stage, but not in Active Directory, only on that WDS server. That was a very good question. That was, a book. Eddie is fixing the books. So this is the way we do it. Another thing that you should be aware of is that if I go into my System Center Virtual Machine Manager, and this is actually configured correctly, if I go into boot images, there are none boot images. System Center Virtual Machine Manager does everything behind the scenes by adding a provider for this. But it is a very decent provider. The provider works like this. If the machine is known, it picks up the machine. If it's set to be deployed, it's going to pixie boot. After the machine has been pixie booted and installed, verified, done, it's going to shift that pre-staged record into pixie abort, but only for that machine. That means it works together with other pixie solution. So if you're using LightTouch or Windows Deployment Services natively, it works in conjunction. You can have it at the same time. It's only together with Configuration Manager it doesn't work, because they have a provider that works differently. They will answer on all the machines and pixie abort everything that is not assigned to it, which could be a problem. So it's only when Configuration Manager is involved you need to have dual pixie servers. Yes, question. So the comment is, there is also an option. Yeah, so there is an option in DSCP where you can set an option of the Pixie class to define it. I haven't played with that, so I shouldn't answer on that at all. But Johan has. It's more reliable to use IP helpers. Yeah, it's always more reliable to use that. So, we have the WDS server. It's up and running, it's installed, and we are supposed to add it. And we add it this way. Installed, done, fixed, no problems, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, and you go to Pixie, and you right-click, and you say Add Pixie Server. Point it to the Pixie Server, and it doesn't show you any information. You need to go down to the logs to see that it was really installed, or you wait a couple of minutes and seconds. Usually it takes less than a minute to add a machine, as long as you have the appropriate permissions. Now, this is fun. I have my Pixie Server, and what I can do with it is remove it, connect to it, and do compliant properties, okay? I also have the luxury of being able to update the Windows P image. However, that is really not going to do nothing at all. It's only going to copy the existing Windows P image to your Windows deployment server. Customer believes that that is going to update the image and do something with image. It could say just copy the image to the same location that it already exists on. Because what we need to do is to add drivers to it. We need network, and we need configuration for IP and VLANs, and we also need drivers. So Let's go into networks and check also the driver stuff. The network is created in the logical network, and you create a logical network simply by saying create logical network, demo, and then you add the VLAN. And if you don't have a VLAN, because it's running natively on the existing LAN, it's going to be zero, and then you define the IP subnet you have, 192.168.133. Now that's taken 34.0/24. And when you've done that, you need to create a pool. So I create an IP pool. Let me zoom into that. Server pool 02, logical network, use existing network site, next. And then I defined in what IP range I will use to my host machines. 50 to 59. I defined a gateway address. A bit more valid. I define the DNS service they should have. Suffix, if I want to do that. And no, I don't have a WINS server. I can't even remember the last time I installed a WINS server. When we have all that in place, we do have the network. But back to drivers. So how do you get the drivers in to the image? Well, I know how to do this in a manual way. And the manual way is really easy. The only thing I need to do is mount the WIM file, take all the drivers, use DISM to inject the drivers. And then I update the WIM file, and then I publish the WIM file, and then I'm done. I know exactly how to do it in a manual step. So I was looking through the documentation on this to see if there was any kind of hints, and tips, and tricks on how to do this. And that is the trick they have, because that's what you need to do. And that's going to be very boring to do in the long run. So what you need to do is to create a script. And this is pretty much how it looks like. You need to mount somewhere. You need to specify the Windows P image. And that is going to be the P image that you have on your System Center Virtual Machine Manager server. You need to specify temp folder, make directory. You copy the original P image to a temporary image. And then we mount it. And then we have a really nice small command, which is get SC driver package. That is a part of System Center Virtual Machine Manager commandlet. And the only thing I do is that I say, take all the drivers that I have tagged in the following way, because you need to import all the drivers into the library, which means that we have the VIM files, sorry, the VHD files, the unattended XML files, the components, all stuff we have in the library together with drivers. Just put them in a separate folder and tag them. Otherwise, it's going to look horrible. For each driver, use DISM, inject it, unmount, and then we run the other command, which is publish that to the deployment server. If you then use the update Windows P image, which you have in the UI, you will copy the original Windows P file. So the update is actually never used. You need to have a PowerShell script to fix this, Or if you would prefer to do it manually, fine, do that. So that's going to look like this. If we go into the library, you can see I have all these driver packages for all these drivers. If I open one of these up, you're going to see it's tagged. So how do you import drivers? Well, depends. There are two ways, of course, manually, which is really boring and tedious, but it works. The other one is to find one of the tools that the vendor has created. So far, I know that Dell has one tool and HP has a tool. They have both something called integration packs. If you download the integration packs, you can install something called Integration Pack for System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2012, and you say drivers. And that will copy all the drivers and tag all the drivers for you. You just need to define what kind of model you have, and they automatically assume that you have a ProLiant server, so they will inject all the drivers for you. The reason why we tag them twice is because we're going to be able to put some of the drivers in the PE image. Not all. We only need drivers for storage and network, that is, for that machine, to be able to boot, to be able to install. The other drivers we might need, we have another tag for them, and we tag them while we actually deploy the machine instead. So we have the drivers, we have the logical network. And we need a host profile. The host profile links to the VHD file that we have in the library. It contains some kind of hardware configuration and operating system configuration. Now, they are changing some of the bits and pieces in System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2012 Service Pack 1, which means that even if I define the profile as a DHCP profile, it doesn't mean it's going to have DHCP when I deploy it, because they added functionality to define the IP address. Also, if you use PowerShell to deploy the machine, you can override all the settings you have in the host profile anyway. So it might look funny when you create this. It doesn't really need to be funny. Host profile, demo. This is the way we do it in System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2012 RTM. We go to the library. We find host profiles. We create a new host profile. Give it a name. We pick the VHD file, which I already imported. And you have the luxury of saying, do not convert the VHD to fixed type during deployment. That doesn't mean it's going to be converted. It's just going to be converted at a later time. And I prefer that. That means that the machine is going to be installed and converted later on when it's fired up. So I normally say, do not convert. Next. Here's the thing. You can either do this. Define what network it's going to be attached to, but you can't define what IP address the machine should have. You can just say, pick an IP address from that range. So that is a static IP address picked from the network I have. If you use PowerShell, or in the Service Pack 1 version, you will be able to actually type in an IP address. You then define what kind of disk this machine should have and how disk management should work. What you should be aware of is that they do not install the operating system directly on the disk. They use boot from VHD. There are numerous reasons for this. The most obvious is They handle VHD files pretty well in the system, so they use Bootrom VHD. And then we have the filtering, which means that for if you do have Dell machines and you have HP machines and you have IBM machines, you will most likely need to create 3 host profiles. In some cases, even more host profiles. Just to be able to define that this machine should have the following filter matching. And you just say filter drivers that is tagged in the following way. HP servers. And of course, then you need to tag all the drivers that are supposed to have this the same way. When you're done with that, you need to define the domain. And you need a runners account that has the ability to join the machine to into the domain. This is the domain admin account, right? No, not really. It is an account that only have the permission to actually join machines into domain and some other things. I just call it domain admin because that's the maximum account anyone will need in my solution. And they always think it's the domain admin account. I tried to do this with the runners account. It didn't work. No, it says domain admin. Yeah, I know. It's not a domain admin account. We need to have a local password on the machine. Some kind of identity. We might need a protocol key. We might need to set the time zone. We could add an answer file. So what's actually happening here? Well, all these settings you have from domain down to time zone, whatever you fill in here is going to end up as an unattended XML file. If you need your own modifications, you can skip all these settings and instead create your own unattended XML file. That could be hard if you've never done one. Steal one. Steal them from Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. They have nice existing working unattended XML file templates. Just get rid of all the stuff you don't need. So the most common things I do is that I point to Swedish keyboard for Swedish people, something like that, or add other components, modifications, things you would really like to do. When you do that, you also have the opportunity to say that you should populate other settings. So if I switch back to another machine, well, I do have this. Do I have it here? I think I have it here. Where's my library? Here's my library. And that's the HP server. And we do properties. Nope, not in that server either. Is it on this one? Oh, here it is. Too many environments, too many servers. It's a lovely job. Please, you have the opportunity to say, should I use the unattended XML file for all the other values I have, or should I just add the additional values? Is this some kind of graphic problem? Yeah, let's try it again. There you go. OS configuration, answer file. Do you want to populate the OS profile with values from the answer file where available? So that's pretty neat. The next one is, of course, the GUI run once. You could add things that said, well, the first time someone logs on, this should happen. Problem is, it's going to happen on a GUI run once. So if nobody logs on, it really never happens. But it's possible to do it in other ways too, of course. But here you can add things like do this, do this. Most customers so far, they are satisfied with the solution. I don't think it's perfect, but many of the customers say, that's fine, we're going to log on to the server anyway. I'm going to verify that everything works before we're going to put load on that machine. And in that case, we can add all this stuff if we want to. In the book that Johan and I wrote, we do something else. So instead of doing this, we add an unattended XML file that logs on as a local administrator. And in the GUI run once, we fire up a task sequence that we have in in Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, which is a custom task sequence that just fixes everything that we need to fix. Install application, install components, do Windows update, do all that stuff, and then it cleans itself out. So that is a way of saying, hey, run this. It is also possible to log on as a local admin, kick off a PowerShell script that connects to something that does something else, or you can also say, well, you run Configuration Manager, install that agent, and run the whatever configuration it needs to run. So there are ways of handing over to something else to finish the last part if you want to. Question over there, sir. Sorry. Setup complete.cmd to finish. Yes, that's true. So there are numerous ways to finish the last thing you want like to do. That is correct. That was a good comment. Unfortunately, you already have a book, and you can't have two of them. So next time you have a good question, you can hand it over to someone else so they can have a book. So we're done with that. So how does this work? Well, it's going to do a discovery and perform a basic hardware inventory using IPMI or SMASH. It's going to collect things like the SMBIOS grid number, and as I told you before, it could be more than one, which could be a problem. It's supposed to give us some basic asset properties, memory, CPU, vendor, model, all that stuff. But that is so dependent on the vendor and the quality of server. So expensive machines, yeah. New firmware, absolutely. They give you a lot of information. Cheap machines, they give you the IP address back. And that I already know. Thank you so much for all the information. So it doesn't really have an information overflow. But another thing in the out-of-band management is that we also collect the logs from the hardware, which means that in System Center Virtual Machine Manager on each and every host, you now have the BMC logs, the hardware logs. So you can, from within System Center Virtual Machine Manager, actually see if you have a problem with hardware, drivers, memory, things like that. We can also control the power state. And that's kind of fun. Why do you think controlling the power state is a good thing to be able to do if you have one host? None. If you have 400 hosts, then you can enable power saving in System Center Virtual Machine Manager and explain for System Center Virtual Machine Manager to save power when possible during the following hours, which means move machines, VMs, from hosts, to condense them into a few of the hosts, and turn the other ones off. That's why they need to control the power state. When the machine is needed, we power them on again and we redistribute the load again. So that is core parking, just a higher level. This is more of server parking. So this gives us the opportunity to do bare metal optimization, bare metal deployment and dynamic optimization and power optimization. The way it works is we have the VMM server. We send a out-of-band reboot. That means that if the machine is running, it's going to reboot. I did try the new deep discovery functionality, and if you initiate that, it's going to reboot too. So when you just ask for IPMI information, it doesn't reboot. When you do deep discovery, it does reboot. That was one of my domain controller. That was a bad choice. So deep discovery, which we're going to have in the next service pack of System Center Virtual Machine Manager, watch out for doing deep discovery because that's going to power off the machine and power it on back again. Losing the domain controller is not a big fuss, but if you only have one, that's a small problem. I also tried with my storage server. That was really a bad decision. Next up, the bare metal machine will do a Pixie boot. It will connect to the WDS server. And as long as you have the correct GUID number in, the machine will say, oh, I'm supposed to Pixie boot. And it will receive a Pixie boot image. So it's going to boot in that. It's going to configure the partitions format. It's going to blank the drives and fix all that stuff. And when it's done, it's going to download a VHD file. After the VHD file is downloaded, it's going to inject the drivers. Happy machine, has drivers, has a VHD file, and then it's going to join the domain because we need to have it the domain joined. After that, it's going to enable a Hyper-V role. And then we're pretty much done. A small issue is when you play with this and you try this and you test with it, in some cases you will see that the machine is really deployed. But if I go into the log file, it says it's waiting for a reboot. And you're looking at the machine, and you can obviously see it has rebooted because it's running now. And you're just waiting 5 minutes. And then suddenly, oh, it's rebooted. So the communication between the agent and the server is not instantly. It takes a while for the agent to connect to the server. So in some cases, you just need to wait a couple of minutes before it finishes. Don't try to restart the machine. It will work. Just wait. It's like Active Directory. Just wait. Sooner or later, it will work. So let's check that out. So number one scenario, and you can see my screen, great. Number one scenario is, and I'm lucky my girlfriend is at work right now, otherwise she will be angry. Before we deploy the machine, we can fire up a PowerShell script. This is a red one. Let's see if we can run this. That is a command you can run just to get information so you know you're playing with the correct machine. As you can see, the manufacturer in this case is absolutely correct. The model, however, is not really correct because that's the remote access card. It has nothing to do with the machine itself. And the BIOS GUID number is a mismatch. Okie dokie. If we run this machine, I think that will work. I did a deep discovery on that machine. That wasn't bright. It doesn't matter. It's going to take a while because that machine is going to boot up and turn itself off. While we're waiting on that, let's deploy the machine with the incorrect SMBIOS grid number. And we need to deploy this with a special command. And here it is. I need to specify the name, and I need to specify the real grid number. The real grid number can be retrieved from the machine in other ways. You need to power it up. You need to find the grid number from a Pixie boot. If you Pixie boot it and you press F12, that grid number will show up in the Pixie log or the DHCP log or the WS log. So it's pretty easy to find it. But you really need to have the real grid number. Then I can define the MAC address. And as I told you, I can't do this in the UI, but I can define this in the in PowerShell. So I define what MAC address, what network card is going to be my management network card. I give it an IP address, and that IP address needs to be within the range of the network I created, the logical network IP address pool. And then I define the IP address of the actual server. Then it's pretty easy. The only thing we do here is that we tell this machine to power up, but then we define what grid number that machine actually has. And that is the grid number that's going to be injected into the pre-stage in the WDS server. So if we run this and everything works perfectly fine, live demos is always fun. Doing live demos on physical hardware, it's like having kids. It's very unpredictable. So if that works, we should see that we have a job running somewhere around here. It's not in the pool. Okay. Let's do 61. Discovery, create a new physical from new host from physical machine. Let's log on to that machine. Hope this works. Yeah. I work for a security company, and so I trust everyone anyway. So you can see the machine is booting up, and as you can see, this is most likely to be the worst Hyper-V host ever. With 2 gigs of RAM, you can't run much, but you can boot, which is the purpose of this. Please boot. Isn't it funny? I go, oh. This wasn't funny. At all. Or was it? Waiting for physical machine to boot. And as you can see, it's downloading the WIM file. And then it's going to boot. And then it's going to connect back to the System Centerverse Machine Manager server and say, hey, I'm working, I'm online, I need some kind of instructions, tell me more what I should do. So while that is working, let's switch over to the other machine and see what we can do here. So I most likely have a job running here, and I'm going to turn that off. Cancel. So let's take the other one. The 127. Control C. And here's the new features we have. As you can see, my System Centerverse Machine Manager 2012 is now running on server 2012 together with SQL Server 2012. And there are some changes. You can see amongst many things that you have the virtual machine networks, which is the PVLAN that you have in Server 2012. But you can also go into Fabrics, of course, and I still need a Pixie server, and I still need to update it in the same way, and I still need to add the drivers in the same way, and I still need to have logical networks in the same way I have in the old version. It just looks differently when you add a resource. So when you do Hyper-V host and clusters, and you select the physical computers to be provisioned, we go next, and I define an account that is a BMC account. And you go next. And then I suddenly have something called skip deep discovery. If you skip deep discovery, it will have the same function as we used to have. Just do an IPMI query to the machine, giving back the information. If I don't check this, it will power up the machine. Pre-stage, power up, do an inventory, turn it off, and then give me some information back. So I'm not going to skip that. Do next. And as you can see, it now says deep discovery in progress, which means power on and wait to get the information back. What kind of information will I get back? You will get back CPU, CPU count, memory. Thank you for that. And also, it's going to give us back the number of network adapters that we have with the MAC address of each on and every one of these network adapters. So you have the opportunity to say, well, this network adapter should have a static IP address from that pool, and I will select this IP address. And this network adapter should have the following IP address with the following configuration. So you will see all the network adapters and you can configure them, which means that you don't really need now to find out exactly how many network adapters you have. But that's not really true. I still have the following problem when I do these kind of jobs for customers. I may not have access to the data center. They're just telling me, we need you to deploy these 45 machines. And then I still need each and every MAC address on each and every machine, and I need to tell someone that the network adapter with the following MAC address should be in that port in that switch. So you still need to do all that work. Otherwise, you have no clue on where things is going to end up. I need to have the management network adapter on a non-tagged VLAN to be able to do that. I need the following network adapters for that iSCSI network or for that whatever network it is for VM traffic. So you still need to do this massive inventory before you do it. But it becomes just a bit easier to configure everything when you then deploy them. So as long as the networking guys or the guys that actually mount the stuff in the rack center or the rack document every connection they do, it works. Otherwise, I still need to run down and jank all the cables and redo it from the beginning. So this is still going to take a couple of seconds. I can go back to that. So besides that, I'm going to shift it back as soon as it power up. There are, of course, other resources, and we also need to fill out the evaluation forms for this session. So I've showed you that. I'm switching back. And while we're waiting, questions, comments, ideas. Question over here. So the question is, how do I keep my host images updated? I'm a strange guy, which means that I have an automated task sequence in Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, which I automatically fire up every Sunday. So I have a PowerShell script within Virtual Machine Manager that creates a virtual machine, install it, run it, turn it off, and Monday morning, I have a new VHD file, and I still manually copy that file. That's the only manual process I have, and I'm pretty good with that. So that's how I do it. I've tried so many other ways, and it all ends up with manual things. I forget to do them, and it's just very boring. Anybody think it's funny to install Windows? There's always wrong somewhere. I think it's funny the first time, the second time, the third time, and from that point on, it's just very boring. It's a good comment. So that's, of course, worth a book, and I think on the first three chapters or something, that process is actually explained. So, next question. Yes, so you need to have teaming. You're not going to have teaming on your management network. You're going to have teaming on, you do? So you want to have, okay. So you want to have LACP teaming. I have tried that. It is close to impossible. So I gave it up. And I will never try it again. I do have teaming on the other networks, but I don't have it on the management network because the management network needs to be Pixie-enabled and Pixie-boot. So, no, I don't do it. It's so hard to make it work. I couldn't make it work at all, even if I spent 3 months on it, because I need to team them before they boot, and Pixie doesn't understand that. So. It's all kinds of mess around that. So teaming is what I use for the production network adapters, VM cards, all that stuff. And that is pretty easy to manage after the machine has been deployed. It is the Pixie and the management network adapter that is hard to do teaming with. So I avoid it because I could never make it work. So the question is it possible to inject some kind of scripts? Yes. The only method you have, it depends on how you do this. We prefer to do it after the operating system has been deployed, which means that I do a log on as local user, local admin, run a task sequence or a PowerShell script when the operating system is up and running, because that's the easy part to do. Then you can do all kinds of scripted teaming things, but just try to avoid managing the management network adapter, then it works. So it's, yeah, you do it in run once, you do it in the unattended XML file, you add a sequencer to it, you use Microsoft Deployment Toolkit with custom sequences or something that is similar to that process, that will work. It is possible to do everything in Windows PE, it's just very annoying and very hard to make it work. Because you're always going to lack the logic, and that's the problem. So it's easy to make it work, but then the success rate will be poor because you need to have a better operating system that has the capability of doing more logical checks, verify that you're on the right network, configuring the network adapters, create the teams and all that stuff. So I prefer to do it in the OS instead. But it's a good question. You already got a book. I'm sorry. Any other questions? Did anyone learn anything? Was it a good session? Johan thinks it's a good session. Perfect. Let's. Thank you so much. And with that said, I'm over time. I hope you enjoyed the rest of the Tech Ed, which is only one session, as far as I know. Have a safe flight back. And don't forget to fill out the eval forms. Please do that. Thank you. Bye.